Hello, welcome to episode 9 of Extra Sequential, your weekly dose of comic book, graphic novel, and manga news and talking, hosted by me, Mladen.
Yes, and myself, Chris Baber.
I wanted to see how long I could go with the intro without breaking it. How'd I go?
No, you did very well.
I got everything I needed to. This will be going to air on the 4th of October, and we'll be telling you all about, this week's news and what we've been reading, and anything else, Chris?
No, that is it, and I just want to clarify that we are recording on Skype, as we did last week, which is a bit unusual for us, but it kind of works out well because we're both a little bit sick, so we should probably remain absent from one another during this time.
That's right. But yep. I guess we should start with the news for this week.
The news. Is that N-O-O-S?
The secret of the news, yeah. Yeah, okay, the news this week. We should start with, I guess things have been very DC-oriented lately.
Yes, last week. Was it last week that we talked about all the shuffling going on?
The big corporate shuffle, the AT employees getting laid off and all this, or relocated. Relocated or laid off. Yeah.
It sounds like another job. Like endangered species. But a few more details have come to light this week. Bob Schreck is now the editor in chief of DC.
That's right.
So he was with Marvel for a while.
He was the former editor in chief of Marvel. Bob Schreck?
I'll edit that out. DC Comics, so he's been in charge of their trade paperback kind of collection for a while. Now he's like the main man, so that's kind of interesting, I guess.
Yeah, no, I looked him up. He was definitely the editor in chief at Marvel, which was it's interesting that they've kind of taken on this guy who has the experience, and I suppose he was editor in chief at a time when Marvel was doing quite well. So DC's gone all businessy. And speaking of businessy, we were worried that they would touch with all the movie shuffling and so forth. We were worried, don't touch DC, the main DC line, or Vertigo.
Yes.
And what do they go and do, Chris?
They're very same thing.
Yeah.
Actually, it's Bob Harris who's the new
Bob Harris. Character. Bob Schreck played Nosferatu. Oh, no, that's Max Schreck. Who's Schreck. Bob Schreck?
There is a Bob Schreck guy that was with DC for a while, but now he got laid off. I think he was one of the guys behind the All-Star line. So now he's writing for IDW. He's doing the Jurassic Park series. But yeah, it's Bob Harris who's the new editor-in-chief of DC, who was, as you correctly surmised, was the head honcho at Marvel Comics back in the 90s, I believe, and he's been with DC for the last 10 or so.
That's right. And but onto the Vertigo layoffs, they've laid off three of their creative editors, basically. So
yes.
Joan Hilty, who's 19, but I'm pretty sure she's only a 15-year veteran for DC. She started with their trading cards and then moved into DC editorial. She gave Brian K. Vaughan his big break on Swamp Thing.
Oh, okay.
Before that, he was an unknown. And also Jonathan Vanken, and he oversaw, I think, the... Oh, no, that's a different guy, don't worry. Joan and Jonathan were in charge of original graphic novel acquisitions.
Yes.
So it seems like that aspect of Vertigo might be getting a bit of a chop. Vertigo traditionally hasn't done too well in terms of... any original titles. Collected editions of their periodicals do quite well.
Yeah.
But I don't know if the original graphic novels do as well as they need to for a company of that size.
Well, they've been doing a lot of crime stuff lately by crime authors in their Vertigo crime section. So I don't know if and they seem to be punking them out. They've put one almost every month. There's at least one or two Vertigo crime novels coming out that are in a different format, usually black and white, by respected crime writers. The new one coming out in December is Noshi Roja by Simon Oliver. I don't know if that...
Well, that's interesting because Jonathan Vanken, who just got let go, was in charge of some of their crime division.
Okay.
So they'll be cutting back on that probably. And also, I love this name, Pornsuck.
Yes.
Yeah. Pichet Shoti.
He must be from Thailand, doesn't he?
I think he's from Thailand. He was editor on Unwritten and Sweet Tooth and Joe the Barbarian, which I hear really good things about.
Yes, that is quite good. Yeah, I mean, you would hope that Marvel or other companies would take guys like these and girls.
Well, the rumors are that Pornsuck will be moving to Marvel.
Yeah, I've heard that rumour as well.
Yeah, crossing the street, as it were.
Yeah, even if it's just because they want someone with his name to work for them. But, yeah, so it's a bit of a blow, unfortunately, for DC. So, I mean, the next couple of months are going to be quite telling. I mean, but it seems that it's a company that knows exactly what it's doing.
I have a feeling there's going to be more reports like this in the coming weeks, though, that's for sure.
Yeah.
This reshuffling might, I think they'll focus more on basically just on Batman, I'm pretty sure. And I have a feeling also that the reshuffling's also going to lead up to the Superman film. So they're probably going to try and focus on launching some Superman titles to tie in with that.
True. Speaking of which.
Yeah, that's our segue. Darren Aronofsky, correct? Are we talking about Christopher Nolan first?
Christopher Nolan has just been confirmed as the director of Batman 3, which is no surprise, but it's official now. And I believe Batman 3 comes out in July of 2012.
That's right. And we also mentioned Chris Nolan was executive producing the upcoming Superman film.
Yes.
And of the candidates for directing, Darren Aronofsky, director of the upcoming Black Swan, that Natalie Portman film, Requiem from a Dream, The Fountain.
Yes.
Yep. Which
I didn't like.
I kind of liked, but kind of didn't like.
No, it just seems a bit too pretentious and a bit too art schooly.
But there's a graphic novel by Kent Williams and Darren Aronofsky.
Yes, there was a time graphic novel with the film. You're correct.
It looks quite cool because Kent Williams got his style. But speaking of Darren Aronofsky, he has been suggested as a very likely candidate to direct the Preacher film for Columbia Pictures.
Oh, okay.
Originally, Sam Mendes was tied to the project back in 2008.
American Beauty.
Yes, that's correct. And they've got the fact that they're mentioning another director in his style makes me think it's not just a rumor. They're at least headhunting a certain type of style, I think, for this film.
So, The Preacher, it is going to be a film, not a HBO miniseries?
Yeah, I think the HBO miniseries idea didn't end up working. For some reason. And, yeah, they're going to go for a film. I'm guessing it's a risk issue for a property like that. But, HBO would have been perfect for it. I've been watching I've recently been watching Carnivale from HBO.
Okay, yes. I've seen the first season of that, but not the second. They only did 2 seasons, I believe.
Yeah, that's right. Well, don't spoil it for me. I'm halfway through the first season, but the style of that show, I could see lending itself to something like Preacher.
Yeah,
HBO are good at that. And then new show, Boardwalk Empire, again. All their shows like Oz and all this stuff, like you could picture them doing Preacher, no worries. But, oh well, Columbia Pictures will be doing Preacher at some point. Who knows who will be tied to it. I know years ago, what was it, Kevin Smith was looking to develop it and James...
Really?
Yeah, and James Marsden was going to play Jesse.
Yes, I do remember the James Marsden. He's the guy who played Cyclops in the X-Men films.
That's correct. I don't mind James.
He's all right. He's a bit of a hunky for the ladies.
Well, there you go.
Yeah.
He played something else, and it's not coming to me.
He was in the Superman Returns film.
That's right. And that's why he was killed off in X-Men 3.
Really?
Yeah. Do you remember how when they were about to film X-Men 3, the Bryan Singer was tied to direct that as well, but he went and did Superman at the same time for Warner Brothers?
Yep.
And he also ended up casting James Marsden in that film. So they were both meant to be in X-Men, and so they killed off James Marsden's character so he could be in Superman. And, look how that film turned out. Both films were dismal. So nobody wins was the message. So look out for a doomed Darren Aronofsky Preacher. I just suspect this project's doomed forever, to be honest.
It's been talked about for so long, hasn't it? Mm. I did hear, actually, going back to the Batman 3, that Edward Norton wants to be the Riddler.
Yeah, I'd heard he was interested in taking some part in the project. I didn't hear about him wanting to be the Riddler.
It sounds like he was kind of cornered by an interviewer, but he sounds like he's pretty keen.
There's this stage where actors go through and just sort of whenever press asks them, they just express their interest in case certain casting people overhear the interview and get the right ideas. So Ed Norton's a smart guy. He knows what he's doing. Did you have any other news items for this week?
I think that's pretty much about it.
Oh, there was one other interesting piece of, I guess it's kind of news, but it's a piece of market research which just came out.
Oh, yes.
You're aware of this as well, I take it?
I am, yes. Please continue.
A company called Simba Information.
Isn't that the white lion?
That's Kimba, the white lion, which was directly ripped off for The Lion King.
Yeah.
look it up, folks. It's a conspiracy. they've released a report called Overview of the U.S. Comic Book and Graphic Novel Market 2009 to 2010. It's a proper report. Like, you have to pay to access it, but so far in the... in their sort of promotional material for it, they claim that their market research is saying that one in four comic book readers are 65 or older.
Yeah.
What do you think?
I think that might be true in Japan, for example, but not in the West.
They're monitoring US sales. The report, it does say US comic book and graphic novel market.
I would say a lot of people over that age read, like, newspaper strips and the Sunday funnies, but I've never seen anyone older than 50 in my comic shops.
Well, I would say it's probably not the comics you're thinking of. It's most likely to be I know in Australia there's a certain we've talked to our local comic book retailers, and you say one of their regular sellers are Phantom Comics, and it's always to guys who are over a certain age. And if you think about the ages of over 65, they are the generation that grew up just reading cheap, easily accessible comics. And, I mean, comics like Archie and so forth still sell quite regularly. I don't know how they conduct this market research, to be honest. But something tells me it might not be too far off the mark. It's probably,
if you started reading when kind of the superheroes exploded in the market again in the, say, mid-50s or early 60s, when Marvel, you know, Fantastic Four and Spider-Man kind of came in the early 61 to 63 kind of period. So if you were 20 years old then and you've been reading for the last 40, 50 years, I guess you'd be in that bunch. And I don't know about you, but I find fanboys and girls are quite a devoted bunch, and that you'll go through periods where you may drop comics for like a year or a couple of years or even longer, but then you'll always go, it's like in the mafia, you know, you find it hard to leave. You'll always go back in there, and I think once you're kind of hooked in comics, you will read them for for your whole life, even if not consistently throughout that time.
I think it might not be less the titles. I know what you mean, though. I do agree. Yeah.
But, yeah, there's probably not a lot of 65-year-old superhero readers, no.
No, I do think it'll probably be the more the spinner racks, because I have a feeling, yes, you're right, in comic book stores you won't see that age group, but I have a feeling this market research might be counting bookstore sales and newsagent sales, in which case you'll be adding on all the all the comics that you and I can't think of at the moment because maybe we don't respect them as much.
Well, I can guarantee that probably you and I, and definitely me, will be reading comics when we're 65.
Oh, I suspect as much. And I would rather burn my collection than pass it down to my grandchildren.
What? Why?
No. I'll share. I'll care and share. But they
I keep all my G.I. Joes and Transformer toys.
That's not bad thinking, because you think they're worthless now, but maybe one day.
Well, they are. Well, only if, you know, they're all broken and scratched. You know. But I just think, you know, it's good because, you know, my nieces and nephews can play with them now. Like, it's all plastic stuff. And back in the day, they were die-cast metal and big, strong toys. But now,
last longer.
Know. Yeah.
All right, shall we move into what we've been reading and watching this week?
I think that is a very good idea, young Lucatan. Okay, what we've been reading. I have been reading, lots of comics, unsurprisingly. Frankencastle 21 came out this week from Marvel Comics. Frankencastle is basically the new direction for the Punisher character, the big vigilante with the white skull on his chest. Frank Castle is the name of the Punisher. And what happened in the last few issues was he's gone away from the kind of street-level crime and he's been turned into a Frankenstein monster. Basically, so then you get the name Frankencastle. And Daken, who is the Japanese son of Wolverine, basically carved Frankencastle up into lots of little pieces and killed him about 6 months ago now. And Frank was reborn by the League of Monsters who dwell in the sewers. And so then he's got like a big, you know, robotic arm and all this kind of stuff. And he's got scars and, you know, cybernetic parts. So that's kind of the direction that the Punisher has been in the proper Marvel universe.
That's bizarre, I've got to say.
Less grim and gritty and more wacky fantasy. But it's written by Rick Remender, and he's a good writer, so it's been going quite well. Mm. This issue, Frankie Castle 21, if you've been missing the old Punisher, this is the issue to pick up, because this is like the bridge between the old, between the new status quo and the old status quo.
Yeah.
So what happens in this issue is, as I said, Dakin and Frank Castle had a rematch in Tokyo in the last few issues, and so Frank was basically bleeding and cut up again, and he was thrown into a river. He washed up ashore to Monster Island.
Monster Island, good stuff.
Monster Island, which is like a classic Marvel...
I like where this is going, yep.
...setting from the 60s, so he kind of washes ashore on Monster Island, and you can guess what is in there.
Well, the picture I'm looking at, which is one of the preview pictures, has some sort of board table scenario of a vampire and a werewolf and... some sort, what looks like Swamp Thing. Oh, no, Man-Thing. It's Man-Thing. It's
Man-Thing is in here. Yes, he's one of the League of Monsters. You've got Morbius, who's like the living vampire.
Yeah.
He doesn't really look much like a vampire. Looks more like a rat mouse. You've got Man-Thing, who's kind of like the Swamp Thing look-alike.
Mm-hmm.
You've got Werewolf by Night. You've got, I think, a mummy dude and a vampire dude and a bunch of other monsters that don't really get used in the current Marvel comics these days. So the Punisher goes to Monster Island. He gets in a bit of a scrap. And then he basically weeks pass, so he kills monsters and lives on them. And then what happens is he gets rejuvenated. He's got this thing called the Bloodstone, which is like a red gem that holds mystical powers. And so that's been stuck in his chest. So that's kind of been reviving him. So his original body parts have been coming back to life. So he's basically gone as the Franken Castle, and in its place stands the old Frank Castle.
So they're
fully human
back,
baby, but just with a bit of a beard.
Cool.
And long hair.
So that is the lead back into reintroducing him to normality?
Yeah. It's pretty interesting because you're aware of Venom, the Spider-Man villain, I assume.
I know of Venom, yes.
Okay, you know him personally. So
we have not been introduced.
Yeah, okay, he's a nice guy. So it's kind of like the Bloodstone is kind of the same thing that the Venom symbiote takes over, like it makes you stronger but a little bit crazy and paranoid, so that's what's happening here. So the League of Monsters tries to save Frank, and at the end of the issue, he basically takes the Bloodstone out of his chest and gives it to the League of Monsters because he wants to be normal and human, but not crazy.
This sounds very complicated.
It's actually not. I just explain things very complicated because I used to be a professor. None of what I just said is true. It's pretty good. And then it's got an awesome backup tale also by Rick Remender and artist Andrea Mutti, M-U-T-T-I, and where... again, it's just Frank is off Monster Island. He's in, like, the hood, and you got two a bunch of gangbangers in New York basically talking very gangbangery. And then Punisher, it's pretty awesome. I won't spoil that for you.
I'm having a look at the art here by Dan Brereton, is it?
Dan Brereton, yes. He did The Nocturnals, which is probably what he's known for. He's got a very lush kind of painterly style. It's a style you don't really see. It's not a penciled ink kind of style. It's more of a full-coloured kind of style. So he does everything himself. He does the pencils, the inking, and the colouring.
Yeah, he's got a really fantastic, I guess, like a very finished look. It doesn't look like patched together between lots of artists who have never met or been involved with each other. It really feels like a consistent work. And I recognise his work straight away from Thrill Killer, was it?
Yes, which was, well, that must have been about 10 years ago now.
Yeah, that Elseworlds tale with Dick Grayson and Batgirl. I can't remember if Batman's in that.
Yeah, I think he is, yeah. You're right. It was kind of Elseworlds was DC's alternate universe kind of tales. It was like set in the 60s, wasn't it? So it was like pretty vibrant and.
Yeah, it was. With Elseworld tales,
anything could happen.
Anything could happen.
Yeah. But it was a pretty good series from what I recall, and it was a very different direction for the characters. Up until then, all the other Batman Elseworlds have been, you know, like Gotham by Gaslight, and Batman was a vampire, or was fighting with Sherlock Holmes or whatever, I don't know.
Yeah.
But this
Mike Mignola and Kelly Jones in consecutive order, what you just mentioned. Yep.
Yep. But yeah, Frucola kind of took it into a different direction, more like, I guess, the 60s TV series, that kind of direction. Frankie Castle 21, it's a good series. And if you've missed the old Punisher, this is the issue to back, because he's back now. There's also, in November, there's a new 5-issue miniseries called Punisher in the Blood, and that's by Rick Remender, the same writer and artist Roland Ibushi. And I just picked up previews this week, and I was reading the solicitations, like the little text that they use to describe the issue, upcoming issues. And so there's a bit of a spoiler in December's issue of the Punisher in the Blood, number 2, before even Punisher in the Blood, number 1 has come out. So that's a bit of an error on Marvel's part. Whoops. So if you don't want to be spoiled, don't read this issue's Marvel previews. But yeah, so Frankie Castle 21.
You know what?
Punisher, pick it up.
I was going to say, you know what I like about the look of this comic?
What's that?
It makes me think of, it's got a Scooby-Doo vibe. These kind of werewolfy characters, and then there's looks like some sort of all I can see are the pictures. There's no captions in the preview art, but yes. The round table of monsters meeting up. It looks like a lot of fun, to be honest.
It's pretty unapologetic. Like it's not done in a tongue in cheek way. Done in a kind of serious fashion. But yeah, you're right in that these monsters are all ones from the 60s, like, you know, mummies and vampires and werewolves.
And with Dan Brereton's style, they have a little bit of a cartoonishness to them. And it's,
they do.
Yeah, and with that colouring, it's the Saturday morning cartoon colouring.
Yeah, the sheriff doesn't turn up at the end and
pull off the mask.
Set off, and it's the local school principal.
But why?
They would have got away with it if it wasn't your kids. Didn't they say that like at the end of every episode?
Every episode, yes.
Yeah, wow.
What else have you been reading this week?
The other one that I wanted to mention was also, not also by DC, because Frank Punisher's by Marvel, from DC, is Action Comics 893. And I actually noticed just on the cover, it's now called Lex Luthor's Action Comics. The last couple of issues, Action Comics is DC's second oldest title after Detective Comics.
Right.
So Action Comics has been going since the 30s. And the last few issues, British writer Paul Cornell has been, his kind of Superman is out of Action Comics, which he's been in for decades, and Lex Luthor is the main star. And when that was announced, everyone was like, what? You can't put a villain as a guest star, but it kind of works, and he's such a good writer. Every issue of Action Comics, Lex Luthor is basically hunting for the Black Ring, which if you've read the Green Lantern tie-in Blackest Night series, the Black Ring kind of revives the dead and gives you powers and stuff. So Lex Luthor is searching for a lost Black Ring somewhere on the globe. So basically it's like a bit of an Indiana Jones search around the globe, and then each issue has him battling a different supervillain. So it's pretty interesting.
Recognizable supervillains?
What's that?
Recognisable supervillains?
If you read DC Comics, DC,
yeah, they're not like new made-up ones for this
time. No, they're all current ones. So this one is Gorilla Grodd, who, if you've seen Batman the Brave and the Bold cartoon, you would have seen Gorilla Grodd.
Yeah, I remember him.
Talking gorilla, who has telepathic powers and runs Gorilla City. So he runs into Lex Luthor. And I just want to read out this quote because it is awesome. All I can say is that Lex Luthor is in the jungle with a little, you know, kind of safari hat on, and it's kind of surrounded by gorillas with guns and magnetic headbands, and Gorilla Grodd, who's the leader, leaps out and says, "Kneel before Grodd. You have walked into my ambush, and I have brought my biggest combat spoon to eat your tasty brains." He's basically just holding a big spoon.
I have a feeling I've heard him say "kneel before Grodd" before, though.
Yeah, I would imagine so.
Yeah.
Because how can you resist a line like that? Kneel before Zod, as you mentioned, Superman 2.
God, every writer thinks they're so smart.
Yeah. So it's pretty good. The artist is usually by Pete Woods, but in this issue is by Sean Chen. It probably won't make a lot of sense if you haven't been reading the last couple of issues of Action Comics, because, there's like, for some reason, they haven't really explained, there's a Lois Lane robot, like Android, that is like Lex Luthor's aide. And so I don't know. He obviously has feelings for Lois because he chose to make an Android of her, so she follows him everywhere. It's pretty good. There's also a backup tale, which is a new regular feature now, which is DC are doing to add more value to their comics. So they'll have, you know, like a few short pages of backup tales in the back of the comics.
Which sounds like Marvel and DC are doing the same thing there.
I don't do Marvel have back. Oh yes, they're doing the Punisher one. Yeah,
yeah.
Yes,
that's why. Yeah, yeah. But is this the Jimmy Olsen thing?
Yes, it's actually called a second feature rather than a backup for Jimmy. Yes, this is the Jimmy
Olsen. It's entirely one, so, different.
Yeah. So it's written by Nick Spencer and art, very cartoony kind of light art by R.B. Silver. And it's pretty good, but it's basically, it's quite wordy, but I actually quite enjoyed it. It's quite fun, very tongue-in-cheek. And it's basically the first appearance of Chloe Sullivan, played by Alison Mack in the TV series Smallville.
Mm-hmm.
DC have been trying to put Chloe Sullivan into their comics because she's not a comics character originally. She was actually a character creator for the Smallville TV series.
Yes.
So it's kind of working in the opposite direction. So yeah, this, and they've been trying to get her in for years. So Chloe Sullivan, this is her first appearance. So if you're a fan of Smallville, pick up Action Comics 893. And she's basically Jimmy's ex-girlfriend, like she was in the Smallville TV series, and Jimmy's playing the Superman, the video game, and then he meets this guy, Sebastian Mallory, who Chloe is interviewing, and he's like kind of Lex Luthor's assistant, so it looks like he's going to be the arch enemy. Yeah, it's actually quite interesting. And if that's not enough, and I know I'm really realizing I'm talking a lot without letting you saying anything, but I've almost finished. There's also a couple of, there's another, well, it's not a backup, it's a preview, from Teen Titans 88, which comes out this month in October, and that's written by J.T. Krull, illustrated by Nicola Scott, a female artist, which you don't see a lot of in comics.
No, that's unusual. Nicola Scott, okay.
She did. She launched Secret Six with Gail Simone.
What's her style?
It's quite, it's almost kind of, it's loose. It's not sketchy. It's quite pretty and quite fine and quite delicate.
Mm-hmm.
Almost like Billy Tookie. Who did She?
Okay. S-H-I. No, sorry.
Okay, it's kind of that delicate kind of line. Yeah, so, and that's the new creative team beginning with Teen Titans 88. So basically, yeah, it's got, you know, Kid Flash and Wonder Girl, Superboy, and all that kind of stuff. So there's actually, yeah, there's three different stories in Action Comics 893.
That sort of makes me wonder, is that an oversized comic? I don't get it. Is it a normal?
No, it's not. I think they're just putting, I don't know, actually, I didn't count if there's actually 22 story pages of.
Yeah,
Luther Tale.
Yeah, because I'm wondering if they're reducing that or if they're reducing the number of ads in the book to get those more those preview pages. And I mean, the backup tale can't be many pages long. What is it, like 4 pages or something?
Yeah, probably about 6 or so.
Six or so.
So, I mean, yeah, let's see. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10.
10 pages of the Lex Luthor comic.
No, 10 pages of the Jimmy Olsen backup tale.
Okay, while you're counting how many Lex Luthor pages, I'll just
And Death is in this. She appears on the last page, and she'll appear properly in next month's Action Comics 894. But Death, the Neil Gaiman creator character.
I don't get what she's doing there, eh?
Yeah, this was kind of a surprise as well. But apparently, it's been in the works for a while because. We did talk a while ago about DC kind of bringing their Vertigo characters into DC proper, and now I guess we kind of know why, if the way things are going. So, yeah, I think that's kind of why, I suppose. Because did Sandman and Death and those characters appear in before Vertigo was called Vertigo, these characters appeared, didn't they? They weren't actually Vertigo-created characters, so to speak.
Sandman and Death, no, they were made by Neil Gaiman. I'm not sure about Destiny, like the older brother.
But the, like the first few issues of Sandman, was it actually a Vertigo banner?
Oh, I see.
Vertigo created after Sandman.
I think you might be right because yeah, I know in the first couple of issues you have Martian Manhunter, you have Scarecrow pops up, like they go, and I think at that point Swamp Thing was part of DC because I know Swamp Thing was before Vertigo.
Mm-hmm.
And Swamp Thing, I think, pops up in Sandman at some stage. And Hellblazer also was just a part of... He was a spin-off character from Swamp Thing. I think Hellblazer was like a launch title for Vertigo, if I'm not mistaken. I'm probably really wrong here.
No, I think they did recognize that these characters are doing quite well and they need their own imprint.
That's right. Then at some point, I think they do exist in the same universe because, I mean, yeah, at Sandman's wake, basically.
Yeah.
What's his face? Superman and Batman turn up.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. They dream themselves there.
Oh, okay.
So clearly they all exist in the same world. But Sandman crosses between dimensions and things so he can do what he wants, I guess.
Yeah. What have you been reading?
Oh, I have I've not been digging into new releases at all. I've been giving my eBay account a bit of a workout. Lately, I've been on a binge on old French comics.
Yep.
And by old, I mean 70s, 60s, 80s. Mm-hmm. Not in that order. Those decades did not happen in that order, I just said. I'll start off with, I've got a whole bunch and I'll be talking about them over the next couple of weeks, so it'll be a lot of fun for me because I haven't got through them yet. I started off with, you remember Epic Comics, the old Marvel imprint?
It was a Marvel imprint back from the 80s.
That's correct. I got, they put out these Mobius collections collecting, that's Jean Giraud, collecting all his work from Maître Hurlant. And that's heavy. That's screaming metal in French, which was then adapted, bought up by American company and turned into heavy metal. So you're aware the heavy metal is not the same company as the old Maître Hurlant.
Yeah, I was wondering what the correlation was. I thought initially perhaps one was a translation of the other kind of thing.
Well, yeah, heavy metal basically took a lot of the old stories from the old Maître Hurlant coming from France and obviously translated, but published them in whatever order they felt like, added new stories in, that sort of thing. Okay. So they, I think they would also take, so they could cross-pollinate between 2000 and AD a bit, you know, the English writers. But this book's been great. I've read a few of these collections now. This is volume four, and it's a collection of all of his science fiction story work.
Yes.
The first story in here is by Dan O'Bannon, who originally was supposed to be working, I think, with Mobius on the Dune movie, I think.
Yeah, because I think he was one of the original writers of Alien.
That is correct, yeah, one of the original script writers. And he basically gave Jean Giraud this kind of pulp detective story, and Jean turns it into this, you know, in his inimitable style, this kind of weird science fiction story where everyone's got very colourful outfits and a mug has got four arms. My favourite scene in it is when he's chasing this assassin up to, like, the surface level of this, you know, multi-floored city, which was, you know, an inspiration for Blade Runner years later. And he's beating him up and he's like, I'm going to give you a chance to get away. Just run across that launch pad and, like, it's a countdown and, like, the guy's like, what? And then he shoots him in the shoulder, like, just run. And the guy's like, sprints, and he's trying to get across before the rocket launches. Okay. And he gets incinerated. It's pretty.
Okay.
Yeah. But it's like, it's just brilliantly rendered. And in the background of that scene, there's an Imperial probe droid, which I mentioned to you earlier was, the design was basically ripped off for the Empire Strikes Back. But Mobius is quite friendly about it. I think everyone was open about it was a period of ripping each other off.
Talking about Star Wars, how did we miss the big news this week?
Oh, yeah, we'll mention that, yeah, because that's annoyed me. But you should say it, because I'm just so mad.
George Lucas has announced that he will be releasing all the 6 Star Wars films from Episode 1, so the prequels first, to, in 2012 they begin, and one every year in the 3D conversion in cinemas. So 2012 will be Phantom Menace, 2013 will be Attack of the Clones, etc. Kind of fans are, I don't know. I mean, I think a lot of people will kind of skip the prequels and just go straight to the trilogy. But
I think what will happen is people will feel the need to support the original, I mean, the prequel trilogy in the hope that they'll do well enough for him to adapt the original trilogy in 3D.
It sounds like he's going to do all 6 anyway, like that's what he's planned.
Well, unless if they bomb, then
he won't. That is true.
Because I was looking recently at a breakdown of the income they make on Star Wars, and basically two-thirds of all the profit is from toys. So I don't think it's I guess in the end it doesn't matter how well the films do on re-release. They're there to promote the toys.
Yeah, which is kind of what, like I think in one of our first, very first episode, we talked about that, didn't we? Yeah, Gary Kurtz, who was the screenplay, kind of said that George lost interest in making a dark film.
It wasn't Gary Kurtz. It was Gary Kurtz helped him on all of the films. I think it was another dude. Yeah,
are you sure about that? Okay, who knows, it was so long ago. We're up to episode 9 if you keep track of such
things. Oh, no, you're right. Gary Kurtz. It was Rick something else who helped with all the films. My bad. Yeah, you're right. Gary Kurtz was basically saying how it became all about the toys, and was he right. And the film, it's interesting to watch how all the films, because there's this infographic going around online of how the films made money compared to each other. And you can see, like, A New Hope made an absolute bundle, and then like Empire Strikes Back and Return of the Jedi made about the same money as each other, about half of A New Hope, but still really well. About 2/3 actually. But they also had more toys and stuff behind them. And then you see a Phantom Menace. This is all in adjusted costs, by the way. Phantom Menace made the same as Return of the Jedi. Yep. And then you see the next two films both make like a fraction of any of those. So you see everyone got burnt on the Phantom Menace. And then the Clone Wars cartoon barely makes a little blip on their little chart.
Yeah.
You know the movie they made? Yeah.
Yeah. There's actually a Clone Wars magazine coming out this month as well.
Oh, boy.
But, there's talk of a live-action TV series for a couple of years, but I don't know if that's
true. I think he likes having complete control over everything, so the CG thing's doing quite well, and he can do whatever he wants there and market whatever toys he wants and not have to worry about special effects. To look realistic, they just have to look real enough for the cartoon. But have we... but we've spoken enough about Star Wars, so I'll just get back to Mobius. In this same comic, he's making love to this woman who turns into this tentacled monster. And
every man's nightmare.
Yeah, and it is this nightmarish scene of where he suddenly realizes, oh my God, look at this thing. And
Captain Kirk wouldn't stop, though.
Yeah.
He makes love to aliens.
Oh, he would. And there's this like, great scene where he's tearing her off him, and she, like, her tentacles are clutching at all of his body parts. Okay. And she's like, no, darling, don't tear us apart. And there's this one bit that's not translated in French because, you know, it's letters within the art. And it says, mon amour, like, my love. And he's tearing her off and screaming. It's great. And then he shoots her. But it's a lot of short stories in here, and they tend to be these little humorous stories, and you see this weird world, like a spacefaring merchant and his wife's nagging him constantly, and they visit this little planet of little guys who look like Jawas, basically. And and then he thinks she's being kidnapped by this tentacle sea monster thing, but really she's eloping with it. And they're like, oh, this great being is found. And then, like, at the end, she's nagging the sea monster. Like, just like, yeah, there's a lot of fun stories in here. There's one which is like, it's basically Giraud's take on the post-apocalyptic thing. So, you know, the world erupting, and then these really stark panels of nothing. And then this periscope rises, and these figures march out from like a bunker. And, you know, gas masks and everything. And then they execute one of their guys, and he turns out to be the commander who refused to retaliate on the Russians for firing nuclear missiles on them. So it's just like this really, how would you describe that? Ironic, deep. It's like, it makes you laugh just because it's so bizarre and you think, oh, what's the point? I love Mobius's work. But the other comic I also read, and this is from... Well, I should mention, the Mobius stories are all from 71 to 79. This was from about the same period, 72, by another French creator called Philippe Drouillet. So that's Philippe, and then Druillet, if you want to look him up. Also worked, like Mobius, he worked on Pilote magazine, the French magazine, and then they both went on to found Metal Hurlant. And I read The Six Voyages of Lone Sloane. And I've got a couple
Six
of...
Six Voyages of who?
Of Lone Sloane.
Lone Sloane. Okay.
So Lone, like L-O-N-E, and then S-L-O-A-N-E, if you want to look it up. His style is like nothing I've ever seen before. With his work, it always feels like the stories don't matter too much. They're these wild spacefaring adventures, which is what this is. Mm-hmm. And then there's an excuse to draw these spectacular splash panels with really psychedelic imagery, very detailed, kind of Baroque detail. Like... I read that a lot of his inspiration is from Indian, his incredibly detailed Indian statue work.
Oh, okay.
Yep, detailed Baroque stuff. And, God, just flicking through this again, I'm reminded about how crazy it is. There's this panel where the guy's, like, basically hallucinating while a god's trying to invade his body. And, he draws the same character in the same pose, like just receding into the distance. So he draws the same guy like what looks like 500 times on the page in the same pose, just like one against the other. It's really, there's a lot of detail. I'd recommend checking this stuff out if you're at all into psychedelic science fiction.
So is it like a one shot or a series of volumes?
This was a series, and this edition I think is from 91, and it only collects, it's from a publisher I've never heard of. I think they're probably defunct by now. Natia, it's just a book publisher. But this, I think it was an ongoing series from 66 till about 83. And this was just like, say, a year's worth of that. It was serialized in the French heavy metal, basically. There's this great page here where you can see all these planets receding into the distance. And on every planet, they're all linked by these arched bridges, like suspension bridges connecting them with these huge spires coming out of them and these screaming, what look like deceased mummified giants, which are supporting each spire. Oh, yeah. I'm just impressed. I was thinking about this earlier. A lot of French comic creators really excel at world building and creating really unique settings.
Yeah.
For comics, which I find you don't see as much, say, in manga or American comics.
And I would say Jack Kirby does, but a lot of his world-building stuff has the same his stamp upon it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like he created all of Thor's world and, you know, like that kind of stuff. But, yeah, I know what you mean.
Yeah. I mean more like, say, the visuals of the background. World building is not so much what I meant. I know what you're getting at. I mean more, say, the appearance of the background world. Like you look at some artists
and
the architecture, like they have this real obsession over detail of where a character is standing, what kind of building is this, what kind of architecture do these people have, what does this alien world really look like, and where some artists like honestly slack off. You know, with this.
Yeah, I mean, or some artists will use photos and kind of use photo manipulation because, you know, like especially in American comics, the emphasis is always on the superhero in the foreground, you know. I see what you're saying.
Yeah, like I guess it's a different effect in that it's slightly more, the characters don't matter so much in, like, say, these Mobius or the Drulier stories. It's more immersing yourself in these whacked-out worlds.
Yeah.
So it's just a different experience to following characters, to sort of immersing yourself in a journey that you're sort of going along with. Say, but like I was looking at, speaking of like sort of building a world, there's a story in here. I mentioned it already. Just like the background, the world's kind of this pink, and there's always bubbles and plants growing and stuff. And then I read each story has an introduction by Mobius.
Okay.
I'm saying what was going on when he wrote this kind of thing. And he said at the time he was like holidaying in, I think in Italy or like on this Riviera. And he says that directly inspired the visuals of the story. And I was looking through it and I'm like, okay, I can see it. Like this rock formation, if you kind of imagine, if you were on acid, like that could be like a building, you know? Like,
yes.
He wasn't on acid, but you could see, there is like this almost, it's for something familiar about it. It's different and whacked out, but a little bit familiar to make it bizarre. I guess that's the key to making a memorable world. And then there's like a little Twilight-esque story in the Mobius one, which I have to mention, where these spacefarers land on what they think is this sand world, and they climb into this like deserted building, and they're wandering through these halls, and like the halls don't connect anywhere. What's going on? And then it falls in on them, and it was a sand castle, and they were tiny. I'm like, that was very, very Twilight Zone.
I'm kind of reminded of the Green Lantern Will World book that was released in 2001.
Don't know it.
Written by Seth Fisher. Oh, sorry, written by James DeMatteis, but drawn by Seth Fisher, who did Batman Snow, which I think you have.
Yes,
Seth Fisher does he's no longer with us, but he does very kind of intricate worlds, and basically a world, which I haven't read, but I know about it, that is basically Hal Jordan kind of mastering his ring and going into all these different, and it's very psychedelic and trippy and detailed. I'd also think of perhaps Jeff Darrow, who did, I think, Hardboard, was it, with Frank Miller and Big Guy and Rusty the Boy Robot. Also does kind of very detailed and intricate background stuff.
Right, yeah. Frank Quietly, who did Snow? No, it was J.H. Williams III, I think, who did Snow. Would that be right?
I think you are mistaken, sir.
Really? Oh, who was it?
It was definitely Seth Fisher.
Seth Fisher. Okay.
Seth Fisher.
Oh, you they had a Google similar style then. Oh,
okay. Seth Fisher. Yeah, he did. The 5-issue Snow story arc of Batman and Legends of the Dark Knight.
Okay, no, I have that. I probably
written
picture
by Dan Curtis Johnson and J.H.S. Williams 3. So J.H.S. Williams did wrote it.
Ah, okay. I probably remembered seeing his name on the cover on then. The cover, or but gosh, yeah. I'm just flicking through the Lone Sloan book again now. If you're at all into, say, H.R. Giger, he would have been their contemporary at the time, and Philip Dullier is doing very kind of not so similar in terms of nightmare imagery, but the same sort of attention to mechanical detail and sensuous forms and these huge frightening objects. And it's interesting how they did all work together, because I remember Mobius did some of the design work on Alien, which I mentioned last week.
Yes, yes.
But let's talk about what we've been watching this week.
Well, I haven't been watching much. I tried to watch Coraline, the stop-motion animated film, which was actually directed by Henry Selick, who directed Nightmare Before Christmas. Tim Burton didn't direct that. Mm-hmm. But and it's based on Neil Gaiman's book. And it was okay. It was it's one of those kind of dark kid styles. Mm-hmm. Nothing. It didn't blow me away with what it was about. Just a girl, you know, finds a secret door in her house, goes in, and then there's this other world with his parents who are oppressive. Like, I don't know, it just didn't captivate me. Like, okay. I said, oh, we've seen all this before, you know, like kids discovering another world and then must rise up to all the outcasts and defeat, like, you know, we see that in every kid's film that Hollywood gives us. So I wasn't that impressed with that. But it looked awesome.
That's interesting, because, I mean, yeah, I saw it maybe last year, and maybe I had a different reaction to it because I was pretty impressed by it. More in terms of, it felt like a return to the kind of films that I enjoyed when I was younger. And, I mean, you're saying, yeah, it's something we've seen before. But if you think about it, it's something a lot of kids growing up today haven't seen, because the type of films that are being made for kids now have this kind of snarky comedy thing going on, like kind of Shreks of the world.
Yeah.
Yeah, where it's all about making topical jokes, whereas Coraline's this more universal appeal, and it's terrifying in parts. It's kind of that film that if I watched it as a kid, there'd be parts where I'd have to turn away,
that's true. I mean,
which are the films you remember as a kid? I remember being terrified of The Dark Crystal in times. So,
I was just going to mention that. The Dark Crystal kind of scared me. Labyrinth with David Bowie wasn't necessarily scary, but like Neverending Story.
They have scary bits and bits that disturb you as a kid, and you don't see that much, but Coraline kind of brings that back, because Neil Gaiman's got a bit of a, I guess he knows the traditional way to structure a story, and Coraline has a pretty definite set of acts. But I love the what's it called, that type of animation with the
stop motion. Yeah, I mean, because when you first look at it, you think this has got to be CGI, but you think it's actually models, and it's very impressive.
And there's bits where you think, oh, they must have cheated and made that bit in CGI, and then you realize no, like in the features they show you how he did it, and like, oh my god, there's like these these incredibly complex light rigs to get this particular thing to happen and stuff. Gosh. But speaking of childhood films, I watched something that might have been from your childhood.
Oh boy. Citizen Kane.
Yep. The Adventures of Citizen Kane and Rusty. Yeah.
There's actually a film coming out called Citizen Jane.
Yeah. Yeah. With Michelle Rodriguez.
Yeah. From Fast and Furious.
Yeah.
I assume it's a parody of some kind.
But. Yeah. The picture I saw had her sitting on like a lava flow, firing a machine gun and screaming. And guess what she was wearing? A black wife beater. What a daring choice for Michelle Rodriguez. She wears that in every film she's in, by the way.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was going to mention Fire and Ice.
Yes, I do remember watching that when I was a kid. It was quite raunchy. It came out, 82, 83, animated film.
83, from Ralph Bakshi, who also worked on, so many films of that. He had this particular style of rotoscoping characters, and he tended to do a lot of fantasy, so he did a film called Wizards. He did the Lord of the Rings animated film, which is still kind of crazy and cool. But This one, he worked with Frank Frazetta, who recently passed away.
Yes.
Famous painter, artist, comic book cover illustrator, as well as comic book artist. And Frank Frazetta did all the character designs and the story writing on this as well, in part with Ralph. And I've got to say, I really dug this.
Cool.
It's a real, like, classic, I guess you could say, run-of-the-mill swords and sorcery epic. But they get everything, like, tone perfect. Like, if you're at all into swords and sorcery fantasy, and this, if you haven't watched this film, it's basically delivers on everything you expect from that without being, it's not tongue-in-cheek at all, and it doesn't, it gives you TNA, like you said, it was a bit raunchy. The girl runs around in the whole film, basically, in a bra and panties, like fantasy bra and panties.
What does the guy wear?
The guy... Yeah, I think he's in a loincloth, and he spends a lot of the film shirtless. And but because everything's rotoscoped, it does have this thing it's modeled on real people walking around and stuff.
So. I do remember that, it just being very fluid, something I'd never seen that style before. It looks like a cartoon, but a live action.
Well, Disney used to do that as well.
They did.
They still do, Snow White's full of it. Cinderella's got a lot of it.
The series used it in certain parts.
Yeah, that's right. Cinderella used it, and I'm sure Sleeping Beauty did as well. Ralph Bakshi had this thing. He doesn't do it in this film, but I know in Lord of the Rings he had this technique where he'd film the actors, and he just wouldn't bother rotoscoping them. He just put these color effects on the screen, it would just be slightly more contrast heavy. And then just actors in orc costumes running across the screen, mixed with these hand-drawn animated characters fighting them. Really bizarre. Okay. But he doesn't do that in this. This is great. I definitely recommend checking this out if you like your fantasy at all, because it's it delivers on the genre. And then
what made you want to watch this film?
You had recommended it to me ages ago, so credit is due. And then I ignored you then. But then recently, my partner and I were in a mood to watch something fantasy and animated, and I downloaded
Spartacus.
This.
Wasn't doing it for you.
That's a terrible show. Have you watched it?
Yes, I think I watched the first episode with you.
This is Spartacus Blood and Sand, if anyone's listening.
Yeah.
I wish I knew what to say about it. There's a lot of nudity.
Yeah.
Yeah, a lot of penis. I just heard a yell from downstairs. Penis, there's penis. Yeah.
I don't remember seeing any of that.
You probably, your mind wiped it out, but you might have to watch it again, Chris, because you're missing out on all the wiener.
Well, I could just watch Watchmen again if I want that.
No, this is a lot more intense.
And it's blue.
What are people so hung up about Watchmen for? I don't get it.
You've seen Watchmen?
I know, but I barely noticed it.
Yeah, me too. I guess it's just not something you see often in cinema.
I'm impressed how often people are so prudish about certain things. And speaking of prudishness, I was watching A History of Violence the other day, and I was struck by... I was watching it on television, and they had in all the violent stuff.
Directed by David Cronenberg?
David Cronenberg of The Fly and Existenz.
Oh, that's a good movie.
The Fly is so good, with Jeff Goldblum. But for TV, I think they edited out some of the swearing.
Oh, okay.
They kept in all the really...
They lied if it shows at a certain time.
I don't get it. They keep in the ultra-violent stuff that happens, but if somebody swears, oh boy, edit that out. I don't protect our children from swearing. But violence is... I don't get it. But it was awesome film. I'd never watched it before.
I have seen it. Based on a comic by John Wagner, who did some Judge Dredd stuff, and with art by Vince Locke, who's done some Sandman stuff. But a Vertigo book as well, published in 1997. I do like the film.
I was really impressed by it.
What was the other film that David Cronenberg did with... Aragorn.
He did another one with Viggo Mortensen?
Viggo Mortensen, yes. They did another film where he's like a Russian criminal and that kind of stuff. That was pretty cool. Not ringing any bells?
It
had Naomi Watts in it.
You know, I think I know what you mean, but it's not coming to mind the name of the film. You look it up, who cares? It's really not important.
I defined it as we speak.
I've watched it.
If you enjoy History of Violence, you'll also... Eastern Promises.
Mm. There's only there's five violent scenes in the film, all up. But three of them are Viggo Mortensen basically killing a bunch of dudes efficiently and very violently and quickly. It happens very fast, but they're all assholes, so it's very satisfying, but it's quite brutal at the same time.
You want to see raunchy Viggo fighting in the nude, then Eastern Promises.
Eastern Promises.
He fights in the nude in that film.
He fights in the nude, does he? Oh.
Yeah, in a Turkish bath.
Well,
house.
That's
not just in a bath, but in a Turkish bath house. Oh, but what I liked about History of Violence is that there's this menace running throughout the film, and you're not quite sure because people, Ed Harris kind of sees Viggo Mortensen in a bar, doesn't he? And then he thinks that he's a hitman or something from his past. But Viggo's like, no, you got me confused with somebody else, buddy. I'm the family man.
That's basically it. Yeah, Viggo stops these guys who are going to basically kill him and rob the store. And then he gets in the news, and then Ed Harris sees him and comes around and goes, "You tore out my eye with barbed wire." And Ed Harris can be a pretty menacing guy.
Yeah.
And, pretty scary kind of.
And you're not sure when you watch the film, like you're not sure if Viggo's lying or what.
Yeah. Like when I was watching, I'm like, is it just a case of a mistaken identity? Is he in witness protection? And then there's the reveal, and it's sort of halfway through the film, so I guess it's not a spoiler. But I guess if you're sensitive about spoilers, I won't reveal anything that happens. But there's some really good performances in that film. And the scenes which aren't fight scenes but are very violent, like there's one where he basically rapes his own wife, but like it turns into this sort of violent passionate sex scene. Cronenberg knows how to make you feel a little bit uncomfortable watching something like this is kind of a turn on but kind of really bad.
That's the power of filmmaking, I guess, but a good film.
I watched The Fly for the first time a couple of weeks ago.
Man, The Fly 2?
Nah.
It's not as good. It's about Eric Stoltz, isn't it? And he plays the Fly's son.
Mm. So, couldn't they have called it Son of the Fly, like Son of the Mask?
Yeah, they could have.
I think that about wraps us up for what we've been reading and watching this week.
It wraps us up like a Christmas present.
Now onto our website of the week. This is this is one of my picks. I was going to do it last week, but yours was way better.
Kickstarter.com.
This is great. This is by a dude called Scott C. He has a site called The Great Showdowns. And what he does is every day he draws these little sketches on these all the pictures are the same proportions. They're like these little square pictures. I guess you should go to greatshowdowns.com while I'm speaking and look, and you'll immediately get what it's about. He goes through basically every nostalgic film I can think of. If just clicking on every older page is a trip down memory lane. But the most recent updates, for example, has Clarice and Hannibal Lecter. And all the characters in their Great Showdowns, they're just one character stands on one side, the other on the other side, and they have this little smile on their face, and they're drawn cartoonishly. And it makes it kind of cute. Like
kind of watercolory style, isn't it?
This watercolory indie style. One of my favorites is a pic from Barton Fink. I don't know if you've seen that film. There's John Turturro on one side of the page and this little smiling typewriter on the other side. And great showdowns. Yeah.
Hey, they've got Labyrinth in there.
Yeah, they got Labyrinth. There's
David Bowie versus Jennifer Connelly.
There's a great one which has Seven. So it's got Brad Pitt smiling on one side of the screen and then like Kevin Spacey with the box with this little smile on his face on the other side of the screen, you know. And
the Super Size Me guy versus a McDonald's Happy Meal.
There's basically anything you can think of. There's that film where Matthew Broderick, War Games. That's the one I'm trying to think of.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. There's Helen Keller and a water spout. And some of them, like, they have subtitles underneath from the film, but some of them you can just get straight away looking
at. Yeah, they don't say what the film is, but they have a quote from the film. Like, two men enter, one man leaves, you know, that's from Mad Max 3.
And what makes it is the cartoonish style. Everyone has these little goofy smiles on their face, and they're just sort of standing there. It's a great little blog to check out just to give yourself a little smile every day kind of thing.
And amuse yourself and your friends with your pop culture knowledge.
Yeah, that's right. Oh, there's one, like, I don't get what it is, and then I read the comments. It says, nobody ever eat 50 eggs, and then I realize it's from Cool Hand Luke, where what's his face? That famous motorcycle. He was in The Dirty Dozen and all those kind of films. Steve McQueen. Steve McQueen eats 50 hard-boiled eggs. It's a cowboy film.
Cool.
He sits down and eats 50 hard-boiled eggs in the film. and that's all you need to know. So, yeah, great little blog. Check it out.
GreatShowdowns.com.
Yes. In the next couple of weeks, next week we'll be going through the previews catalogue for...
The previews is, for those of you not in the know, I love previews.
I hate previews.
It's a little bit, I know, but we'll talk about that next week.
Yes.
And maybe I can convince you of your error.
Mm.
But previews is the name of the catalogue that comes out once a month at every comic shop around the world. or English-speaking comic shop, and it's a catalogue full colour of the stuff that is coming in 2 months' time. So basically retailers and consumers order from this catalogue. Marvel have their own little one, but it's usually hundreds of pages thick, and it's got comics and books and novels and toys and weird things you won't find anywhere else. So we will be talking about
our picks,
the good, the bad, and the ugly.
Yeah, our picks and our avoid these for this week selections. And in the next couple of weeks, you'll also get a Halloween special. It's that time of year.
Sure is.
And we'll also, next couple, I don't know when we'll slip it in, but we'll do a greatest detectives of all time theme, I think, at some point.
I think, yeah. Did Miss Marple ever have a comic?
Yes.
Or Hercule Poirot?
Possibly Blue Water Comics have released a Miss Marvel comic.
Yes.
I'm sure they have a Murder, She Wrote comic.
Yes.
Is there anything they won't do?
Yeah. Well, they've got the comic coming on the life of Mark Zuckerberg, the founder of Facebook, coming out shortly.
They're so scummy. They just pick whatever movie is coming out and churn out a comic within a week. I'm sorry, Blue Water Comics.
Well, it's a good movie. You can't, I mean... Yeah, and then they've done comics on Winfrey and Barack Obama. They sell well, but all the Twilight cast have their own.
Yeah, but they underpay their artists and writers. They don't proof check anything. There's no editing team, and they just churn this stuff out on cheap just to get the impulse purchases going in the store. They get me so mad.
Wow.
Yeah. We need to do an episode where I just bitch about Blue Water Comics for an hour and a half. Very special extra length episode.
We won't expect to get any freebies from them then.
I'm happy. I would be happy if I never got a single freebie from Blue Water Comics.
Yeah, well.
Yeah, I'm putting it out there.
They do some good stuff. Like they do, William Shatner's working with them now. And I don't know if it's good.
You're not convincing
Vincent
me.
Vincent Price stuff. So they don't just do bio.
What do you mean Vincent Price stuff? Vincent Price is dead. What are they doing? Just cashing in on
it? It's basically like an anthology. It's like Vincent Price Presents. So it's like an anthology.
Wait, so they're cashing in on the visage of Vincent Price after his death?
Correct.
But
people do that on Elvis and Marilyn Monroe and, as you said, Steve McQueen. And people do that. And they'll probably do it for Tony Curtis, who just died.
Curtis Presents from Blue Water Comics. No, thank you.
No, that probably won't work.
I'll talk about this every week from now until December. As long as they keep releasing comics, I will keep complaining about them and telling people not to buy them.
Wow.
Okay, and on that note, I think that wraps us up for this week.
Yeah, thank you for listening. If you want to see all of our podcasts, you can go to extrasequential.com. You can also Google extrasequential on mixcloud.com.
That's right.
And iTunes.
You can check out more of Chris's work at comicbookjesus at blogspot.com, something like that.
Comicbookjesus.com.
.com, sorry.
And yours is purgeorder.blogspot.
Yeah, no, just purgeorder.com is the music for the show.
Bananas.
Yeah.
I'll be dancing to it this very evening.
I'm sure you will be.
Privacy of my own bedroom. I'll draw the curtains, crank up some Persian audit, and shake my moneymaker, baby.
That sounds like a plan. Could you tape this for me, please?
I will put on a webcam right now.
YouTube, here I come. And I guess you'll hear from us next week, folks.
You sure will.
Bye.
Thanks for listening, as always.
See ya.
Bye-bye.